Hello, everybody. This is Flareon Films, and this week we're doing Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan.
Hit the music.
Beyond the darkness, beyond the human evolution, is Khan, a genetically superior tyrant. Exiled to a barren planet, banished by a starship commander he is destined to destroy. Left for dead, he has survived.
Hey, I'm Michael Flaherty.
And I'm Colleen Flaherty.
As previously mentioned, this is Flaherty's on Films, which is a podcast about films.
And we're doing the new fan favorites, AFI. And this week we're talking about Star Trek II, Wrath of Khan.
Recommended to us by our brother, John.
Who doesn't really remember if he likes this movie at all, but apparently there's something really important CGI related about it.
It is a movie.
Michael, tell us what it's about.
Here's a summary, probably from IMDb, I think. With the assistance of the Enterprise crew, Admiral Kirk must stop an old nemesis, Khan Noonien Singh. Did I get that right?
Sure.
From using the life-generating Genesis device as the ultimate weapon.
Oh, no.
Colleen, what were your initial impressions of the film?
I enjoyed it, but I don't know if it was very good.
Yeah.
Because I think that what I enjoyed about it is kind of fan service-y.
Oh, sure.
I think we'll get a little more into this when we talk about facts and stuff, but so the first one was like very conceptual and high budget, and it failed terribly. So they're like, why don't we just appeal to things that Trekkies kind of like, and we get to hang out with our favorite characters, and it's just a really simple story, and yeah.
That's sort of my impression, except I'm not really a fan of these characters.
I am.
So, and it's kind of pointless of a movie, because its main theme is undercut by other movies.
Getting older?
Facing death.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely undercut by the next film.
Which is like a lot of this film is facing the no-win scenario, which they win.
But then that's the real point, because according to Captain T. Kirk, there are no-win
scenarios.
Is that
really the theme?
Well, it's not the theme, but that's his idea.
Anyway, let's go to our first segment.
I mean, if you watch this in 1983 or whatever, you wouldn't know.
It's probably better then.
Okay.
Let's go back to the 80s, and then we'll like it. And let's go to our first segment.
Fan favorite.
Bam.
Time for Sam.
This is like fan service for our fans. It's the segment.
Oh, thank you. So needless to say, Star Trek, the motion picture, was a flop. So creator Gene Roddenberry started work on a sequel that involved the crew going back in time to prevent the JFK assassination.
Whoa.
I want to see that movie.
It was like this whole thing, but okay. So anyways, he handed the script in, and the script was immediately rejected by the Paramount executives, and he was, quote, promoted to executive consultant, which is basically a fancy title, and he had no creative power.
I've heard that Gene Roddenberry is difficult to work with, like famously so.
Is he the one who passed away and then was put up in space?
Probably.
I think he was. Okay, anyways. So a new Paramount television producer, Harvey Bennett, was brought into a meeting with the heads, who asked him flat out, could you make a better Star Trek film than the first one? Sure. Next question. Can you make it for less than, quote, $45 million? Bennett would reply, where I come from, I can make 5 movies for that. He got the job.
A little follow-up. Gene Roddenberry was the first space burial in 1992.
Yeah, I think he was like attached to a satellite or something.
Probably.
Yeah,
very just cool. His body. Just
his no, no, his ashes. It wasn't his body.
And it was just a portion of his ashes.
There you go. So he got the job. Something he didn't share before he got the job was he hadn't seen the original show. And now he was tasked with basically reviving the series.
Luckily, there's only 3 seasons. So,
Bennett had found the first movie boring, and he decided, after a lot of thought, that the real problem was it lacked a true villain. So, once he had the job, he quickly watched all of the original series and found the perfect villain in the Space Seed episode, Khan. He created
season 1, episode 22, I believe.
He created the outline and sent it out to be created into a full script. So a lot of this crew that he brought in was actually from the television unit. So that's kind of a big difference from the like movie industry versus the television.
Yeah, sure.
They were able to kind of keep it on a budget, kind of keep it tight, and kind just like different things they did made it different than the movie and made it feel more like the original TV show because it was TV people making this movie. One of the big concerns from the studio, big concerns, was the budget of the film. It doesn't seem like they care about quality on this. They just wanted the budget under. And so this film would end up costing only $11 million,
wow,
which is $35 million less than the first film. But it was much more action-packed than the first film, which is very interesting.
Yes.
So a fact that our listeners might not know is Colleen is a huge Trekkie.
No. Sam is overestimating that a lot.
She is a huge
Trekkie. It's like her favorite.
Oh, she's obsessed.
She knows everything. Ask her Star Trek. Anything about
just
Star
ask,
Trek.
Yeah.
She will go on and on.
Okay.
It's like a little crazy and obsessive.
It's insane.
It is not that at all. Everyone needs to calm down before I get a bunch of angry questions from our male listeners.
Just go ahead.
So I picked Colleen to come up to this recording, and on the way, she was giving me all these Trekkie facts about this already. So, needless to say,
normal Sunday.
Yeah, right. It's kind of pointless for me to try and come up with facts because Colleen already knows them
just
all.
So many.
So we're gonna try and just throw out a couple of random facts that maybe she didn't know, and we'll see how we go from there. The rest of the facts will come in through the
oh,
rest.
Boy.
Of the-
oh boy!
How about this fact, Colleen? Did you know?
What a framing device for this.
Khan's henchmen were actually Chip and Dale exotic dancers.
Do you know that claim?
No, I didn't know that, but that's phenomenal.
Apparently, also, there was some comments of fans that Khan's body...
I noticed.
was actually
that's
like...
That's a huge Trekkie. I noticed those pecs. Thank you.
was actually, like faked, like, a plastic, like, thing.
That was fake?
No. That's, like, the theory. That was 100%
wow.
Him.
We have to talk about that for a second because, so this is the original actor who played Khan in the TV show, and you're looking at these, the other main cast, you're like, wow, it's really been a while. It was, the original series ended in 1969, and this was like 1982,
yeah.
So it's like 11 years later. They did not age well.
No.
But Khan.
Khan.
Hello.
Hello.
In the time between those two, so he filmed the original series, and then he was on like a Love Island show or something. I don't know exactly which show. But he played like this really nice host and was very like sweet and loving. So he actually had a hard time coming back from that and becoming like this mean character again. Because
he knocked it out of the park.
This actor is crazy prolific. I believe he's a Mexican actor who started in the 40s in Mexican cinema and then came to American television. He said, like, if you go on his IMDb page, it's like 180 roles or something ridiculous. And his latest role was playing, voicing a cow in Family Guy.
Of course.
And he makes this, they were doing an animal rights bit, and he's like...
But in here we call it Dachau.
Dachau?
Dachau. Except we spell the cow part C-O-W, like cow. So it's kind of sort of a dark joke.
Yeah, it's a Holocaust joke. That's really funny.
That's a good Family Guy bit.
And like it pointed out, this is why I didn't put too
all
much
right, right.
Does Clean like reason. Family Guy more or Star Trek more? We don't know.
I know a lot of... I'm not like a Family Guy super fan, but I do seem to bring it up a lot.
So when they were, you know, getting the cast back together for this, Leonard Nimoy was very angry about having to get back into this role because he hated putting on the fake ears. Which...
Sure.
I've heard is an issue with a lot of actors. But anyways,
it's not like the Grinch level. He's fine.
Yeah.
They got him to come back by saying he would have the greatest death in motion picture history.
But then it's all fine. Don't worry about it.
So originally when they were coming up with this film, Spock was supposed to die early. And they compared it to Janet Leigh dying in Psycho. Mm-hmm. Like, you kind of, this is the main person, and then they die early, and you're like, oh my God. Kind of a thing.
Does Spock know he's not the main character?
Well, actually, this was a big contention in the original series where really thought that he was the main character, and he and James
William Shatner.
Kirk, William Shatner, they did not get along at all. In fact, they were not speaking when he died.
Oh.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, in fact, there was actually a famous, they were meeting with the director and the producers, and they're like, who is the fucking main character? I'm like, it's Bill, whatever. And apparently that's kind of the crux of their feud, was people tend to like Spock more, but William Shatner is the technical lead.
Yeah, interesting.
Sorry.
Yes, that's, yeah, we expected it.
You're not a Trekkie at all.
I've watched the original series like twice ever. Like, that's how much I am a Trekkie.
Uh-huh. Twice all the way through?
There aren't that many episodes. It's three seasons.
Yeah, right. Yeah, okay. Sure, yeah. But, however, so this original script was leaked, and fans were furious. In fact, apparently they called into the producer and left messages on his answering machine.
How do you leak a script before the internet?
It's a great question.
Mail it to somebody?
Just like mass mail it to people?
I accidentally mailed this out.
Yeah, I did not mean to do that.
So I assume you leave it somewhere careless. Someone picks it up who realizes it's valuable and then sends it to somebody in the media. That's how I assume that
and
would
then,
happen.
Oh, so there's like a newspaper.
And then they report it.
Oh, interesting.
So they would actually call into a producer and leave messages. He got one including things like, you kill Spock and we'll kill you.
Jesus.
So
nothing's changed.
The script had
imagine if he was a woman
to be reworked. Yeah, so one of our new characters we meet is Savik.
Spock, or sorry, Vulcan Christie Alley.
Yes, played by Christie Alley. She was a huge Trekkie and wanted to be in this film. And one of the big things is she cries during Spock's funeral. That wasn't in the script. And apparently William Shatner was very angry because Vulcans can't cry.
Yes, they can. Okay.
It's can you not explain to me why?
Well, no, it's like, so yeah, it would be out of character for a Vulcan to cry, but it's like, it's a misnomer that they have no emotions. They just
control. Yeah, it seems like they're like, oh, we're logical. We're not emotions. Seems like that's stretched all the time.
All the time. Yeah.
seems kind of fake.
They just, as a species, pride logic over emotion, and they find emotion useless, or they don't always understand human emotion processing, but they can feel emotions, especially every 7 years.
I feel
years
like that when torch has been taken up by like terrible men online.
Right?
Like Ben Shapiro destroying people with facts and logic so he could be transphobic. Right. Yeah. See, anyway.
Good point, Michael.
I don't know where I was going with that.
Please so continue. There was a deleted scene that explained that she was more emotional than other Vulcans because she's half Romulan.
Sure.
But well, you're always half something so that you can cry, yeah.
Right.
So anyways, there is a scene where Christie Alley and Leonard Nimoy speak together in Vulcan. They actually used English on the set, and the sound designers made up Vulcan based on their lip movements and then had them dub.
Oh, weird.
Okay. So those are my quick facts about the film. Wrath of Khan opened June 4th, 1982, and it was a hit. It made over $14 million in the first opening weekend and became the largest opening weekend gross in history.
Wow.
It earned over or almost $79 million in the United States, becoming, well, that's your question of the week. In 1982, what does it make in the number of highest grossing films list?
In 1982?
1982, the whole year.
So Star Wars, or so Empire Strikes Back came out 2 years ago. So like, okay.
I'm going to say seventh.
Fourth.
It was sixth.
Ah, good job, Michael.
Isn't 1982 like a year that like a lot of films came out?
I feel like it was, yeah.
So although this is not in our AFI list, it is nominated for several. So it was nominated for the 100 Years, 100 Thrills list.
Sure.
It was nominated for Cannes for Villain. And my final fact for you today, it was nominated but was not on the top 10 science fiction films list.
Interesting. Cool.
That was bam. Time
for Sam. So 1982, we've got
Blade Runner, I think.
Blade Runner, Tootsie, Rambo First Blood, Tron, and E.T.
Damn.
So yeah, it's a big year.
It's a big year.
All right. Now let's go to our next segment, Critics Corner. Now I have to say, I thought this was like a fan service-y, kind of very specific film. So I was very surprised that 87% of critics liked it and 90% of audience members liked it.
I'm going to start with the first one. A brisk, handsomely designed film in which its hardware, sturdy as it is, never overwhelms its humanity.
I can't believe 10 years old or higher people could enjoy movies like this. I seriously wonder what kind of people Trekkies are, says Amazon customer.
Here's some variety stuff, a variety. Star Trek II is a very satisfying space adventure, closer in spirit and format to the popular TV series than to its big-budget predecessor.
Agree with that. Very boring and slow movie. As a Star Trek fan, I am surprised that they came up with such a boring movie.
Here's from David Kerr from Chicago Reader. If only director Nicholas Meyer had grasped the implications of his tale more fully and enthusiastically, this might have become a classic piece of cornball SF poetry. What does that mean?
I assume science fiction?
Oh, yeah. But as it stands, the tepid acting and one set claustrophobia take a heavy toll. That's kind of harsh.
Yeah. A little behind the scenes. So obviously our Amazon reviews are always the one-star reviews. And I think people, especially now, only watch this if they already kind of like Star Trek, because there were very few to choose from.
That's true from a lot of movies, though.
That's true.
Yeah.
So this last one. All the Star Trek movies except the first suffer from a fatal flaw that keeps it from being a great film. In this film, Kirk's failure to raise shields at the approach of a Starfleet vessel not responding to repeated hailings is the fatal flaw and is a result of sloppy writing.
Agreed.
If Kirk hadn't been able to communicate with a friendly ship, he would be far too seasoned to take offense if they raised their shields. And working for years for the U.S. Navy, I can say someone who screwed up that badly would be held responsible for a military court. And look how many lives were lost because of that one mistake. Yes, including Spock. So one star for pathetic writing, said Confederate.
I actually agree. That was stupid that he didn't do that.
That was pretty dumb.
What's your favorite part? Oh, it's your least favorite part, actually. I like starting with that.
I actually didn't really have one. I do, like I said, I don't think it's a great film because I feel like most people I know who are, especially around our age, just really wouldn't enjoy it if they came in cold. Hmm. But I did not come in cold, so I liked it. What's your least favorite
part? Was that your least favorite part?
Yeah, my least favorite part is a bit fan service-y, I guess.
Oh, sure. My least favorite part is that it's pointless. I mean, I feel like...
So your least favorite part is the sequels?
No. I mean, I just feel like its main theme is just has no weight to it.
I guess I don't agree because I think of the film as its own thing, and I feel like the theme comes across very well. Kirk finally gets his no-win scenario.
I mean, I don't know. I still don't like it because, like, if I die, I don't want that to be about someone else. You know, it's like when Spock dies, it's still like all Jim Kirk. It's all like...
If you've seen the series, it's always about
Kirk. I know, and I don't like that. Everyone's like, oh, Jim, are you okay? He died and he's your friend. But it's like, it's about Spock. He died. You know what I mean? So it's like, oh, I finally face my no-win scenario. No, it's like, you still are alive. Like, fuck you.
Well, I think... So this is kind of a problem throughout the Star Trek series. And I think this is true of Next Generation and all of them, where there's a very clear... ranking of how valuable people's lives are, the kind of classic red shirt thing.
Yeah.
Because, like, it's so funny how, like, everybody gets around for the stately funeral at the end, but, like, a bunch of people died before that.
Yeah.
And nobody really cared.
That's interesting. Yeah, so I guess I just don't like Kirk that much. And it's even Spock dying is still a problem for him.
It's, yeah.
Like, not a problem for Spock.
Well, no, because Spock wouldn't care, Michael.
And the Genesis device itself feels like such a MacGuffin. Like, that's clearly what it is.
Sure.
But it, like, feels so pointless. Like, it just could have been replaced
by
anything.
Don't you like Next Generation? They do that all the time.
Yeah, but it's a show, and I feel like it's about things. Like, this movie is about a villain, and they have to kill the villain, and then they kill the villain.
But then it's really about mortality.
Not. I just felt like it was...
Getting old.
Even in this one movie, I still felt it was very weak.
That's fine. What's your favorite part?
Khan, the actor.
Ah, that's my favorite part too. He's so dynamic. He's amazing. That actor.
Yeah, when he's on screen, yeah, he's the best.
Do you know the Klingon proverb that tells us revenge is a dish that is best served cold? It is very cold in space.
I don't even know if that's a very good line, but the way he delivers it is very good.
Yeah. There's nothing like a million times. So before we get into it, I should say, I also feel like if you don't know the background of this movie, I feel like you are a little lost on exactly who Khan is in relation to Kirk.
That's kind of bold that they took an old episode and I'm like, let's just expand on that one episode.
Right. So they kind of mentioned he's a superhuman. So he was one of the leading warlords in the World
Here we
War
go.
In the 1990s eugenics wars.
Yes.
So they, you know, a bunch of very ambitious scientists, they use that word a lot, ambitious, came together and made a bunch of...
As opposed to the scientists who just like to... Yeah.
Well, so I thought the original episode was really interesting. It was sort of like... I mean, it was about eugenics and how it doesn't really work. So, note at home.
Oh, okay. Doesn't work.
Right. Because, okay. Like, you can't... Well, I think their big thing is you can't breed out human foibles, which is also kind of prevalent in this film.
Is the theme, life finds a way?
No.
Oh, okay.
So, yeah, I think that they kind of make this point in this film, but you don't really get that point unless you've seen the original episode, which is not good. So then he escapes with his people on this ship. Where they're all in a hypersleep, which I think they use that in one of the new Star Trek movies. Because I believe Benedict Cumberbatch plays Khan, because who's more genetically perfect human being than Benedict Cumberbatch?
Just like such choice. A perfect.
Oh, sorry, that was mean.
You're so mean.
Well, he's okay.
He's all right.
Anyway, yeah. So then he decides he's going to take over the ship and kill everybody, and they get the best of him. And also, they have a sexy redhead on board who is the ship historian who falls in love with Khan. So he talks about his wife dying on this barren planet. Mm. That's her.
Oh, okay.
Because she decides.
I mean, I get all that. What would I be confused by?
Well, just his backstory, but also again the
they
eugenics
explained
thing.
The backstory.
Not enough, I thought.
His wife died. I mean, that's all you need to know. He wants to kill James Kirk because of revenge.
Well,
that's all.
Kind of funny is at the end of the film. So James, they like bring him in for like basically a court proceeding, and they're like, "Hey, here are your options. You can go before a military court, or we can leave you on this planet." And he says, "You know, have you ever read Milton? I love the idea of having a planet to rule and to cultivate." So it actually wasn't a really like horrifying end for him, which was interesting.
That does add to it.
Right? Yeah. I don't know. I thought.
Yeah, I like that actually.
Okay, so let's get into the intern summary, which is a little long, guys, so sorry about that. Michael, do you want to start?
The film opens as Vulcan Christie Alley, she probably has a name, Savik. Savik commands the Enterprise with the original crew, except Kirk. She attempts to save the ship in distress, the Kobayashi Maru, but instead kills everyone aboard. Just kidding. It's a simulator, and Kirk was there all along.
You didn't think that was a fun opening?
Yeah, I thought it was fun. Did I say it was not fun?
I don't
what
know.
What are you trying to get me? Is this gotcha? Kirk and Spock, yeah, it's fun. Kirk and Spock are training a new crew for the Enterprise because they are just too old. Kirk and Dr. McCoy, speaking of old, celebrate his birthday in a sad midlife crisis
Although,
kind of way.
If you've seen the old series, Dr. McCoy looks the same, actually.
He's just always permanently old.
Yeah, he's always old. Actually, one of my favorite things about the original series, and what always keeps me, is the three men always have like the snarkiest, bitchiest dialogue between each other. Yeah. It's one of my favorite things. Anyway,
yeah.
Elsewhere, one of Kirk's former junior officers, Pavel Chekhov, and Chekhov's current commanding officer, Captain Terrell, are surveying planets for a super secret science project, the Genesis Device, an engineered missile that can be fired at a dead planet, instantly turn it into paradise. Terrell's ship, the Reliant, is off looking for the right dead planet to test the thing.
But the Genesis device has a wrinkle. Shooting it at a dead planet gets you paradise. Shooting it at a living one gets you a paradise after it destroys every living thing on that planet first.
Right. I mean, is that any more of a plot device than the Borg? I mean...
Right, yeah.
They find more than they bargain for. Oh, no! After detecting life forms on a planet...
Wait, hold on. Isn't in the Star Trek universe, isn't there no hunger? Like, everyone just has everything?
It's a post-scarcity economy, but not everyone was within, you know, the...
So if you're in the upper class.
No. Like, sometimes, you know, people just get left behind. Because, you know, there's the directive, right?
Prime directive,
yeah. Where you're not supposed to interfere with a planet's development. So if you're not aware of space, you don't get to be part of it.
I'm just saying, their explanation for why the Genesis device is a thing that they would want to use. They're like, oh, we'll have more resources. Like, don't you have all the resources you need, right?
Yeah. That's a really good question.
I just don't know why, besides to be a plot device.
I'm sure there are at least 100 essays on why that works online right now, but I'm not going to research it. But I feel like that's a really good point.
I feel like I've debunked them all.
You did it.
My facts and logic.
Good job. Did I ever tell you I read this really long article about why Captain Picard would have a vineyard in a post-scarcity economy?
You have told me that. Yeah.
Sorry. You've told me that before. Anyway.
Just, yeah, it's classical Trekkie.
After detecting life forms on the planet that's supposed to be rock-infested emptiness, they beam down to find a squad of maroon bad guys. Why wouldn't Chekhov know that if he was on the crew and they originally did that?
We're finding so many plot holes.
They were left here by Kirk way back when and promptly forgotten about while the formerly livable environment took a turn.
Led by the unfrozen 20th century madman Khan, played by Ricardo Montalban, they stick a pair of mind control earworms in Chekhov and Terrell before seizing control of the Reliant.
Man, that little speech he does before he puts a worm in him, good stuff.
The worm is scary too.
That's very scary.
What a scary worm.
Kirk and his crew learn about this when they get a garbled message from Carol Marcus, former flame and scientist in charge of Genesis, who demands to know why Kirk is taking Genesis away from her. Turns out that's just Khan trying to draw Kirk out and get a hold of the Genesis device himself. Boy, does Kirk not care that he has an estranged son, huh? That'll come up later.
Yeah, it's funny. Kirk is a bastard.
Oh, totally. I mean, but that's kind of a thing. That's a pretty consistent character.
Don't like him. It works. Kirk and the Enterprise think that Carol is in some kind of trouble, and Starfleet agrees. The ship goes on its merry way, only to cross paths with the Reliant, which was lying in wait for them.
Khan phasers the Enterprise and would have finished the job were not for Kirk's fast thinking in the Reliant's hackable shield system. Both ships retreat, damaged beyond the ability to continue the fight. The Enterprise limps its way to Space Station Regula 1, headquarters of Project Genesis, with the Reliant threatening to return and finish the job.
I don't want
to
skip over how just Jim Kirk just beefs it. He's like, oh, the ship, it's not responding. Oh, it's sidling up to us. What's going on? It's not talking to us. What are they doing? And Christy, I was like, all right, let's do the shield. He's like, no, hold on. What are they doing? What's this? Fuck, they're firing! And they're like, dude, you're the captain, man. Anyway, which pair?
It's okay, just like one person dies. It's not a big deal.
Yeah, it's just one. It's not Spock.
Right. Kirk and
Kirk and an away team beam over to the space station where they find a lot of dead doctors. And Chekov and Terrell, still secretly under the influence of the earworms. He also finds the transporter room with coordinates seemingly in the middle of a nearby dead moon. After a tense conversation with Mr. Spock about the progress of repairs to the Enterprise, they follow the transporter coordinates to see what's what.
There, they find an underground cavern occupied by Dr. Marcus, her son David, and a doctor, along with the Genesis device. The doctor. Chekov and Terrell take the opportunity to spring a trap, killing the doctor and revealing their status as Khan's personal zombots. Khan, who's been listening the whole time, orders them to kill Kirk.
Terrell, fighting the earworm's influence, phases himself into oblivion rather than shoot Kirk.
Which, again, really draws the question of, like, hierarchy of lives mattering. Yeah. Because, like, he killed the doctor and nobody gave shit. And now he's like, kill Kirk! I'll kill myself first!
Yeah, I had to, like, rewind. I'm like, that guy just died, right?
he died.
They did not care about
that. Like, even, you know, the people who were with him, like, oh, I guess that happened. Well, extra man died.
Yeah, they don't even do that. While Chekov collapses and sends the earworm slinking out of his brain for Kirk to conveniently phaser, Khan settles for the draw. Khan settles for the draw, beams the Genesis device onboard the Reliant, and heads off looking to finish the job on the Enterprise, leaving Kirk and company stranded in a cavern for all time.
Kirk and Dr.
What was his plan there? Because, I mean, the Starfleet knows where they are.
I don't know. He was going to get away with the Genesis device and have it.
Yeah, but I mean, he didn't. He knows they're not marooned.
Does he know that? Well, oh, that because Starfleet knows where they are.
Yeah, why wouldn't they?
I don't know, man.
There's so many holes, man.
Kirk and Dr. Marcus have a heart-to-heart about the relationship, getting older, and the fact that David is actually Kirk's son, which he doesn't seem to really...
Yeah, Kirk knows about the son. He's like, oh, that must be David.
Oh, my son.
Oh, that's the son.
Oh, I thought... No, they have dialogue that she did not tell him, but he does not care.
Oh, I thought the dialogue was like, why doesn't he know about me? But I might have missed...
Oh, I thought that she didn't tell
him. Yeah, I'm going to trust you more than me.
Because... And then, yeah, she's like, well, I wasn't going to let him know because while you're off having your space travels, which I actually don't think is okay. I think you should tell people that they're fathers, probably. That's just me.
That's good.
Take a look at the bountiful wonderland and the rest of the cave. I actually thought this happened in Search for Spock, so I got that wrong. Courtesy of an earlier stage of the Genesis experience. And then she goes, can I cook or can I?
Yeah.
Then Kirk checks back in with Spock.
Things are better than at first suggested. The ship has enough power to beam them back up. Kirk and Spock have spoken in code, suspecting rightly that Khan would be listening in, and fooled their nemesis into believing the Enterprise was more damaged than it was.
But it's still pretty damaged. Warp power is inoperative. They don't have as much firepower as the Reliant either. But there's the Motura Nebula nearby, which would render phaser lock and shields inoperative and basically give the two ships a level playing field. Kirk and the gang head toward it with all deliberative speed and goad Khan into following them.
We have like 9 paragraphs more. It came on its side as the nebula, the two ships circle each other, looking for an edge. Spock finally suggests...
This is the most ridiculous part!
And by noting that Khan thinks two-dimensionally, like a ship at sea, rather than three-dimensionally, like a spaceship in Nebula.
It was like... So this... super intelligent Superman like doesn't realize that a ship can go up and down.
It's like oh, fuck yeah, this isn't like an ocean. God, you know, I'm smarter than this. This is an off
which,
day.
Which I actually think is supposed to be a whole point about how eugenics isn't real, and he's not really a Superman, and he's very petty and narrowly focused
but
on revenge.
We can't pretend like they're making that point in this.
Maybe not. The Enterprise hits the reduce altitude button, because I can't go up and down.
Oh yeah, that fun feature.
And waits for the Reliant to pass over it, then pops up behind it and phasers it into the Stone Age. Kirk and the gang prepare to beam aboard and take Khan into custody, except that Khan has an ace up his sleeve, the Genesis device, which he starts building up to a detonation which will destroy the Reliant and the Enterprise along with it. They need warp speed in 3 minutes in order to escape the explosion, which is something they can't do with their busted engines.
Here we go. Sad part's coming up. As the ship tries to desperately limp away, Spock takes matters into his own hands. He heads down to the engine room, then uses a Vulcan nerve pinch to disable Dr. McCoy. I didn't know what that was when
That's a Vulcan nerve pinch. Everyone knows that.
Well, I know it now. I didn't know it at the time. Who's standing between him and the thing preventing the ship from going.
He enters the irradiated engine core to fix the damage or restore light speed just in the nick of time, taking a bunch of radiation in the process. It is insane that a ship that uses radiation and they would not have one protective suit on board. That's crazy.
I think this movie might be dumb.
But that's not the point. The whole heart of it is campy, but, you know, makes you think.
But it doesn't make me think.
Oh.
The Enterprise speeds away as the Genesis device goes off, destroying Khan and the Reliant and imbuing the nearby planetoid Nebula 1. The planet reshapes itself into a beautiful swath of green.
It comes up later.
Kirk then gets a comm call from McCoy telling him to get his butt down to the engine room before Spock organs turn to goo.
I thought this was a lovely part. So Kirk and Scott have a final tearful goodbye to the clear walls of the engine core, with Spock accepting his fate and admonishing Kirk not to grieve, since the needs of the many outweigh the needs of the few, or the one. A funeral service is held, and Spock's body is placed in a photon torpedo and launched at the newly formed Genesis planet. I thought Kirk's, his William Shatner's overacting was actually really poignant in the moment where he's giving the eulogy. But the one point where he goes, in all my space travels, I've never traveled with a soul that was more human. And it's like, is that racist?
Well, I was thinking, that doesn't even seem like a compliment. Because like in some sci-fis, you know, there's androids who like secretly want to try and be more human.
Data.
Right. And Data. And they'll say like, Data, you're so human. It's like a compliment. But like, Khan doesn't have that aspiration. He doesn't want to be
Spock.
More... What did I say?
Khan.
Oh, Spock doesn't want to be more human.
Right, he's always fighting it. And I think what he was trying to say is that he imbued the sense of humanity in his friendship. But I don't feel like it came off that
I'll way. Reveal the secret code for me. If I refer to anyone as like, wow, that guy's really human. That's not a compliment. I'm not like saying that guy's a good guy.
Anyway, yeah. Is this your turn?
Spock and Kirk and Spock have a tearful.
Nope.
Kirk, attempting to read a copy of The Tale of Two Cities, which Spock gave to him on his birthday, is interrupted by David. The young Dr. Marcus encourages him to listen to the wisdom of Spock's last words, and also that he's proud, very proud, to be your son.
Why? We don't know. Don't worry about it.
He and Kirk embrace, and Kirk returns to the bridge to watch the sunrise on a new world, rejuvenated and at peace, because it's about him. That's the story's about him. He's the main character.
Remember the part where he has to wear reading glasses because there's a future thing to fix eyes, but he's allergic to it? We also have to talk about, there's a very famous scene in this where William Shatner really goes balls to the wall acting, and he goes like, Khan! Khan!
The line, yeah.
Yeah, and I remember that part, but I don't feel like he's reacting correctly in that moment, because what happens is Khan calls him up and he's like, he's basically just using a bunch of flowery metaphors for I'm going to kill you.
Yeah.
And it's like, we already knew that.
Yeah.
This isn't new information that would make him so angry that he would yell like that. Like, if he said, I'm going to hunt down everyone you love and kill them, maybe.
I've never seen this film, but I did know the line. And I knew that Spock died. I thought he said the line because Spock died.
Right.
Which would have made sense.
Yeah, see?
But he's just continuing.
He's just saying it because he got information he already had about Khan that he wants to kill him.
It was a weird line.
It was so weird. It was a weird line read. He's like, oh, so I'm reacting to this. What if I crank it up to 300? You know? Anyway, everyone
The director's like, you know, we're on a budget. What's this fine? He can do that.
So yeah. And as Michael said, in the next movie, Spock is fine. But then in the fourth movie, they time travel to 1980s.
Let's go to our next segment, Bro Call, where we call our brother John. Call, fuck you, Siri.
Anyway,
call,
it's The Journey Home. Everyone should watch
call
it.
Call Brother John.
It's directed by Leonard Nimoy.
Hello, John. This is Flurries on Films. We're talking about the movie Wrath of Khan. Have you seen it? What do you think about it?
Oh, hi, guys.
Hi.
Yeah, I actually watched it approximately an hour ago.
So yeah, okay.
Really well versed on it.
Hell yeah. Give us your thoughts.
So the funny thing is, I think I put it on the list. When I was making my original list, I was literally thinking I was putting good candidates and we were going to have a discussion about it. So I put it on the list just because I knew it was the first movie to use CGI graphics.
Mm-hmm.
I hadn't actually seen it before.
Okay.
When I put it on the list. And I have to admit, I really, really like it. It was a good movie.
Okay. Oh,
okay. Continue.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting that, especially since I'm a little bit biased against original Star Trek.
You're biased against original Star Trek?
It's just is so hokey, the old TV show. I just never get behind it. But that the story of Wrath of Khan, Richard Ricardo, is that his name?
Mondebelt, Richard, and some
he's
we
so
don't know.
Good.
Ricardo,
he's so good.
He's the best part. Yeah, he's awesome.
So good.
Yeah.
The story actually makes cohesive sense.
Mm-hmm.
Just didn't see it coming. Very pleased.
Okay,
that's awesome.
I think it would have hit harder had I not known the thing, like, oh yeah, Spock's going to die and they're going to make a whole thing about it. Because I was able to check out once Khan was dead, but yeah, really good.
Okay, awesome. What would you grade the film?
I also have to say that CGI graphics bit actually was impressive.
Oh, the Genesis planet?
Oh yeah, we didn't talk about that, John.
Thing, that all of it was the first CGI, I think.
Oh, this.
So it was the first, like...
Did Sam already tell you that?
No, it was the first, like, extended CGI scene in a movie. It was a very specific first. It wasn't the first time CGI was ever in a movie.
Oh, I'm still counting it.
Okay.
I don't think it deserves the new AFI, even though it would be kind of nice for something in that Star Trek series to be there. But I'll give it a straight B+. I like it. Would recommend.
Awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. That was Bro Call. So, Colleen, what do you grade this film?
I'm going to give it a B. Because I like it very much, but I see it's flawed. And it's honestly just not that enjoyable. It could be campier. Could be sillier.
Hmm. Okay. I will give it a C. I felt like it is fun and watchable, but not really. And you have a lot of options if you want a movie like this. Better than this movie. Like, I would recommend any Marvel movie over this movie. And I feel like you'll think just as much.
I do think it's weird that this came out between Return of the Jedi between Empire Strikes Back and Return of the Jedi. It's because those are better films.
Yeah, they are. So I feel very good. And C is not even that bad of a grade.
No, it is.
I like C films. So that's it for Films Clean. Who are we sponsored by?
We are sponsored by Nike.
Ooh, gotta run fast. Beat the competition. Get a pair of Nike shoes. That's just good things. You have a joke?
Nope.
Fuck.
No, they're just fine shoes. So now we have to pick our next film.
Yes.
All right.
I'm so excited to hear what it is.
And it is Sight Cannot Be Reached. Hang on. Wall-E.
Wall-E. Okay, cool.
Sure.
Yeah, all right.
And that's it for Flurries on Films. Raise 5 stars on iTunes, please.
And cut.